Well, we've heard accusations that the church has censored things, but here's a Jewish author who says the Jewish community has a censored view of Jesus, and he wants Jesus to be uncensored.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, you know what day it is. That's right. You know what day it is because you know what's on the radio. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I have a thoroughly Jewish guest. We're going to have a thoroughly Jewish discussion and probably some thoroughly Jewish disagreements along the way. Michael Brown, thanks so much for joining us today on The Line of Fire. Number to call, 866-348-7884. Once our discussion gets going, if you find yourself in agreement with my guest, if you find yourself in agreement with me, if you find yourself having another point of view, we'd love to have it. 866-348-7884. You can weigh in online, askdrbrown.org. Just click on The Line of Fire. You know, there's a joke, if you have two Jews in a room, you have three opinions. And there's a lot of truth to it. And sometimes you just grow up, I can't quite say why, you grow up with kind of a debating mindset, mentality. It's just very natural when you hear something to challenge it or come back with, and even if you kind of agree. But I'm really intrigued by a book written by my guest, who I'll be introducing shortly, Bernard Starr. He was author previously of a book called Escape Your Own Prison. He's a psychologist, journalist, and college professor. But his new book, I actually downloaded it when I saw it and then just have a copy in my hands now for our school library, Jesus Uncensored, Restoring the Authentic Jew. Where did this come from? What created the interest? What's the cause of this Jewish journey? Before I introduce my guest, I was reading a book some years back by a Jewish anthropologist, and in the midst of it, he was talking about what he called circumlocution in Jewish law, or loopholes in Jewish law, and the mentality that went with it. And somehow, in the midst of the book, he was talking about telling jokes, and how there's a joke that when you tell a Frenchman a joke, that he laughs the first time he hears it, then he laughs when you explain the meaning to him, then he laughs the third time when he actually gets it because they love to laugh. When you tell a British person a joke, he laughs the first time when you tell him, then the second time when you explain it, even though he doesn't get it, just being a little bit more stiff in personality. When you tell a German a joke, he laughs the first time, he doesn't get it, won't even let you explain it. When you tell a Jew a joke, he first interrupts and says, no, I've heard that before. Then as you continue, he goes, no, that's not how it goes. And then as you continue further, he goes, no, here's how it goes, and he finishes it. Well, I was sitting with a local pastor along with two international students that were in his school of ministry. Oh, they were probably in their 40s, I would say. And I told them this joke, and they were all laughing about it. And the pastor proceeded to tell me a joke he had heard. At which point I interrupted him and said, yeah, I've heard this one. And then when he went into it further, I said, no, that's not how it goes. And then when he continued, I said, no, here's how it goes. And I finished it. He then went to a second joke, and I proceeded to do it a second time, after which we all burst out laughing at the table because I had just done twice before we realized it, the very stereotypical thing that Jews typically do. But I want to hear this input, this viewpoint. What in the world gets this Jewish psychologist and professor on a journey of wanting to discover who Jesus, the real Jew, is, and wanting his own Jewish people, my own Jewish people as well, to take a fresh look at Jesus? We'll be back with Bernard Starr, author of Jesus Uncensored, on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on The Line of Fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right. We are going to get into a very interesting discussion. I'm about to have a debate with this author and fellow Jewish professor. We're going to dialogue, and I want to find out about his journey. Number to call, 866-348-7884. On this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Welcome to the Line of Fire, Professor Bernard Starr. Thanks for joining us.
Well, glad to be here with you.
Now please let our listeners know some of your own background, psychologist, journalist, college professor. Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, basically, I'm an academic. I taught psychology at the City University of New York, Brooklyn College, for 25 years, mostly developmental psychology to prospective teachers. Along the way, I got interested in, I was a consultant to a publishing company for many, many years, Springer Publishing Company, and along the way stumbled into the field of gerontology and started a series there that brought me into that arena where I did a lot of publishing. I started a couple of book series for Springer on that. Initiated the annual review of gerontology and geriatrics. All these things are quite removed from religion.
Right, which is part of my curiosity. So gerontology, yeah. For those that might not be familiar and haven't reached that stage of life yet, what is that?
Well, the field of aging and the boomers, and it was an exploding arena back in the the early 80s, and universities were just beginning to develop programs in that, and once I, as representing Springer, I stumbled into a gerontology association meeting at the Hilton Hotel in New York, and it didn't take me long to realize, hey, this is the way society is going, and indeed it was. So I started a series called Adulthood and Aging, and all of those books were gobbled up by everybody I signed up in it because all the universities were just beginning to get into that and developing PhD programs. And but during that period, I was interested in spirituality, and like a lot of Jews, drifted into some of the Eastern traditions, explored that, and wound up in India for briefly until
really?
At one point. Yeah.
What was that?
With several. Well, not that in the late 80s or so, early 90s, and hooked in with several groups, and I was fascinating with Eastern philosophy and tradition and spirituality, because like many Jews, and you've heard this story over and over again, Jews after Bar Mitzvah, you never see them again. And we know the whole history of that the rabbis, the ministers, they have people at a very impressionable age, and they fail to impress them. And then, of course, they complain later about how people drift away and lose interest. But I would point the finger more at the religious leaders who fail to inspire.
Got it. Very interesting.
So anyway, I was involved in that, and then I got involved, with Jesus and the New Testament, and that's traced somewhat to you. You'll be surprised to hear.
Well, you know what happened? I had your book. I started looking at different parts of it, but I missed the part initially until I started to go through it carefully when I knew I was going to have you on the air. And I thought, whoa, I'm part of this journey. So I'll let you tell that story. But you've just got me curious about two other things. First, number one, the aging issue. I came to faith in 1970 when I was 16 years old, but I got caught up in the whole counterculture revolution. For me, it was drugs and rock and roll and all of that. I didn't go the way of Eastern religion, but we really speculated a lot about it back then. But I don't think there was the slightest thought in any of our minds that Mick Jagger at the age of 70 and the Rolling Stones would be performing, or that we just had Bob Dylan in his 70s here performing in our city the other day.
Yeah, that's quite remarkable.
Is there a different view on aging now than there was a generation ago?
Well, you know what they're saying, that, what is it, the 50 is the new 30, 70 is the new 50. I'm waiting for somebody to say that death is the new ballroom dancing. Well, people are healthier, or some people are healthier. I think there's a mythology around that, because I think that a lot of our current longevity can be attributed to our advances in medicine, and that we could keep people huffing and puffing along for greater lengths of time. But there are many who are healthier, who are active. And, of course, I think there's been a revolution in how people think about aging and think mm-hmm. about themselves. And there are people who have, led that movement. A friend of mine, Ken Dykewald, California, with his organization Age Wave. So I think there's a whole revolution going on. And, of course, we keep adding years to life. This is a fantastic statistic. When I first heard it, I didn't believe it, but I tracked it down. And it's true. For 99% of the time that human beings have been on this planet, life expectancy was less than 18 years of age. You know, so what we call longevity is a very recent phenomenon. Up through the Middle Ages, life expectancy from birth was about 40, and even at the time Social Security was initiated, it was about 63, so they didn't expect most people to collect. And now it's up to an average of, 77, 78, something
interesting.
Like that.
Yeah, and you still have countries that are more impoverished and with less health care.
Right.
Or war-torn, where the expectancy can be in the 40s as well. And by the way, just a quick word to my listeners. If Dr. Starr says something that is not theologically orthodox, or you're saying, what about biblical genealogies? My goal is not to interact with every sentence. My goal is to let my guests speak freely, and then we can have some more focused conversation on Jesus in the New Testament. So that was just a quick side note from my listeners there, who are wondering the age of the earth and all these things and length of human life and so on. So we put that part aside. But yeah, just your closing thought on the aging thing, and then we'll return to Jesus Uncensored.
Well, I'll segue into the religion arena, because I've written several articles about this, quoting one of the early pioneers in the field of aging, Jim Buran. And he wrote a piece called, initially, 15 Commandments of Old Age. And later he narrowed that down to 9. I guess he didn't want to outdo Moses, so he reduced it to 9. And it was about the responsibilities of old age. He was setting a new standard for morality in old age. He said, that the Bible says, honor thy father and thy mother, but there's nothing about who older people are to honor, what their responsibilities are. And he said that was probably because through most of history, there was no such thing as longevity. But now that people are living longer and longer, raise the question, well, what are the responsibilities of older people? And I think you're going to hear more and more about that as this longevity keeps skipping along.
Yeah, very interesting. Of course, we need to keep the birth rate up. Otherwise, there'll be no one to take care of the older generation than the coming generations after.
Oh, wow. But that's a huge issue in Western Europe.
Japan is dealing with it. Russia is dealing with it.
Italy, no more bambinos. I mean, their birth rate is something like 1.2, and you need 2 just to
right.
replace
and no, the population. Right, and no big fat Greek wedding with no family there to care for. Yeah, it's obviously
right.
We've got about 30 tangents we could go on that are fascinating.
Yeah,
I had
we
one
could
other
discuss
tangent.
That forever.
Right. What other tangent?
One thing
I'll,
you opened
I'll
with,
off.
You said when you opened the program, you told the story about the. You have 2 Jews in a room, and there's
opinions. I want your take on that.
I've been finding recently there's 5 opinions.
Right, that's probably true. What was your take as a psychologist on the Jewish joke story? When a Jew hears a joke, the first thing he interrupts, I've heard this before.
Oh, yeah, maybe it's not politically correct to say, but there's always some element of truth in stereotypes.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, there are certain characteristics that Jews have, in humor and telling jokes and responding to things. So I resonate with that. I thought it was a good story.
All right, tell you what, we've got a minute before our next break. Could you just introduce how I tie in with the odyssey of this book, Jesus Uncensored, Restoring the Authentic Jew?
Well, I wound up at your debate with Shmuley on, when was that, 2004?
Yeah, who really killed
on,
Jesus.
The Passion of the Christ.
Yeah, yeah.
You would, the film that created this huge brouhaha Jews were afraid it would revitalize or resurrect a lot of anti-Semitism and whatnot. And it was a brilliant debate. I mean, both of you are classic debaters. People should go hear these debates, if for no other reason, just to see what a real debate is like, with actual facts, passion. I mean, it was quite fantastic. But that, but I got caught up in a lot of the questions that were raised and started reading the New Testament, saying, well, you know, what is all this brouhaha about? And
all right, let me just jump in, cut you off in mid-stride. So you go to the debate. I'm curious to know what brought you there. And then the questions that led to a surprising and unorthodox book, Bernard Starr, two R's, Jesus Uncensored.
Fire we want, for fire we
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
In fact, just jot this number down, 1-800-278-9978. And the bibliography to my guest's book, Bernard Starr, Jesus Uncensored, Restoring the Authentic Jew. He references one of my books, The Real Kosher Jesus. If you don't have this yet, we did it last Thursday. I'm going to do it again. It's a $15 paperback, yours for your gift of any size. So be as generous as you can to help us with our radio expenses. 1-800-278-9978. Make sure you get the book, 1-800-278-9978. All right, Dr. Starr, I want to ask you a question or two and then let you just roll with it. First,
sure.
What was it that prompted you to go to this debate? It was packed out at the New York Hilton, about 1,000 people there, Rabbi Shmuley, my dear friend, and myself. Who really killed Jesus? And then what were some of the questions that got your attention and got you on this journey after that?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. There's something always a bit mysterious about what gets you on a journey. I can't recall specifically whether it was an ad or whatnot. At the time, I was also taking some Torah classes, which was new for me, mm-hmm. with a very charismatic Hasidic rabbi, Simon Jacobson, who actually now revitalized his father's newspaper called The Allgemeine. It's becoming a rather prominent Jewish publication.
Sure.
Just questions that came up and things that I read about the movie coming out and the fears of Jews, and I wondered. And what came out also was about the Jewish Jesus, and I said, well, where did this notion come from then that, you know, the Jews killed Jesus? This is a prevalent view among Jews that I've spoken to then and even today. They still, are under the influence of that charge. And in fact, in an article I wrote recently, I cited a friend of mine who said that when she, some years ago, entered Syracuse University, and she met her roommate for the first time, and the roommate was from upstate New York and had never met a Jew before or had any close association with a Jew. And the first thing she said to my friend when she found out she was Jewish was, oh, you killed our Lord.
No.
So she said it kind of jokingly, but, I mean, just the fact that that thought is still there lingering.
Yeah, a reflex, that's amazing. Yeah.
I'm not
surprised, given that I've written about the history of anti-Semitism in the church, especially the Western church. Okay, so that drew you to the debate, and then afterwards it raised questions for you. What were the main things that you started to pursue?
Well, I was curious, well, where did this come from? Even if it was that you had one turncoat Jew among many who turned Jesus in, although that's questionable now, you have this new Gospel of Judas. But I said, well, even so, and that prompted me, in fact, in the book I wrote about, did you hear anybody ever say the Americans killed Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King, or the Americans killed John F. Kennedy? Well, it's true, an American in each case, killed him. But we then don't say, okay, let's go get those Americans. They killed all these people. I said, well, you know, where did that come from? And then, so this prompted me to start reading seriously the New Testament and the Gospels in particular, which I wasn't thoroughly familiar with. And by the way, I found out since that, of course, most Jews have never read it. And I, much to my surprise, I find that many Christians haven't either. You know, there's a lot of, you know, ignorance about that. One of the statistics that I stumbled into, I hadn't seen before, maybe you had, was actually I had a site for the Bible where you could research different things. And I just put in the term Jew in there, and it came up 202 times in the New Testament, 82 times in the Gospel, and Gospels. And, of course, the term Christian doesn't appear at all in the Gospels, and it appears only three times
exactly.
in the New Testament.
Exactly.
Maybe the first time in Antioch, maybe, I don't know, 10 years or so after the crucifixion.
Yeah, at least. At least.
And
probably
I said,
more.
Well, I mean, this person was thoroughly Jewish. And and I then reached the conclusion, which I later found out that many Christians have cited also, even you know, you're familiar with Bruce Chilton and his comments in his book, Rabbi Jesus, where he said, it became clear to me that everything Jesus did was as a Jew, for Jews, and about Jews. And that's what I had discovered, too. And I said, well, how is it that there, where did this anti-Semitism come from? Where did this notion that Jews killed Jesus when all of the multitudes were Jews, where he only associated with Jews? And I searched and searched and couldn't find anywhere where he said he was starting a new religion.
Absolutely true.
So that
true.
Spurred me on. And then I raised other questions. And the one thing that you cited, and I'm sure a lot of Jews aren't going to be happy with that chapter, which I call the Jesus phobia, because there's no question that Jews have a phobia about Jesus. As a matter of fact, just recently I was addressing a group of predominantly, I'd say 90% of the audience were Jewish. And these were older people, I'd say 55-plus at a course for retirees, et cetera, et cetera. And I opened with, I was telling them about this book that I wrote, and I opened with particularly, and I wanted to emphasize it, I said, you know, I said, I love Jesus. And I paused there. And then I said to them, how many of you cringed when I said that or squirmed? And practically every one of them raised their hand. And I said, well, why? And then they gave the usual lame answers, which I'm not sure we'll have time to get into today, about, well, he said he was the Messiah, and he wasn't the Messiah, and he led to so much anti-Semitism, et cetera, et cetera. So my response was, I said, do you know that Jesus was more Jewish than anyone in this room? And I challenge you to debate me on that. And, of course, nobody did. And I would guess that that statement would hold true for most Jewish audiences who cringe at the name
so.
Jesus.
I would think so. Look, I was doing an outreach lecture one time at Yale University. So this was at a university in a lecture hall, and two Hasidic rabbis came in from Lubavitch. One was the campus rabbi and then a colleague of his. And I was asking the question. It was when the Lubavitch Rebbe, the Grand Rabbi of Lubavitch, had his stroke, and they were waiting for him to kind of rise up gloriously and declare himself as Messiah. So I said, well, will the real Messiah please rise? And let's look at the credentials with all respect to Rabbi Schneerson. Let me explain why he's not the Messiah and Yeshua is. So they came in, and we had a Q&A time at the end, and I kind of let them talk at length to honor their presence there and to have a good, healthy interaction. But one of the guys, even though it was a lecture hall, when he said he wouldn't say the name of Jesus, he said something close to it, and then he spat on the floor. And I was not in the least bit upset with him for doing this, but I was reminded of the degree of antipathy and hatred and revulsion in his heart towards Jesus. Bernard Starr has said God killed Jesus. That's what the Gospels say. We're going to continue this conversation on the other side of the break. And to get your copy of The Real Kosher Jesus, my book, eye-opening, must-reading, for your gift of any size, 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. Thanks for standing with us, friends.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on the Line of Fire. Michael Brown, so glad to be with you. The number to call, 866-348-7884. I'm holding in my hands a fascinating book, looking at a chapter with some, images. It's chapter 10, The Ethnic Cleansing of Judaism in Medieval and Renaissance Art. I want to get to that shortly with my guest, Dr. Bernard Starr, psychologist, journalist, longtime college professor, and a man who went on a journey to discover who Jesus really was and wants Christians and Jews to look at him afresh. And there's a lot we agree on. There's a bunch we disagree on, but my goal is not to have a debate today, but to hear from Dr. Starr and his own journey. I may have time for some calls, 866-348-7884, but the best thing you can do is weigh in online, askdrbrown.org, and just click on the line of fire. Dr. Starr, thanks again for being with us today. When I debated my friend Rabbi Shmuley, which was April of 2004, and you were there at that debate, and that's part of what got you on this journey, I said that a true follower of Jesus is not mad at anyone for Jesus dying on the cross. We thank God for it. It's our favorite verse, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him will not perish but have eternal life. So we thank God for the death of Jesus. And then Jesus said he laid his life down freely. So whoever was culpable, be it a high priest or a small group of Jews that were against him or the Romans or whoever it was, we're not mad at anyone. And yet, through church history, Jews were often singled out as Christ killers and persecuted and even killed. But you've made the statement that God killed Jesus, and that's part of Jesus' prayer, Yeshua's prayer, Father, forgive them. Could you explain that concept and how you came to it?
Well, first I was intrigued by this the history of this whole whodunit and, where they introduced the usual lineup there. Was it Judas Iscariot? Was it Caiaphas? Was it the Sanhedrin? Because he was criticizing them for not being spiritual enough and just proudly displaying all of the rituals. Was it the Romans that they want to get rid of him because, as we, I don't know if you want to get into your debate with Shmuley about the Rambo.
We can leave that one out. We can leave that one out for right now.
That they wanted to get rid of him because he was an insurrectionist or a threat to Rome, or was it Pontius Pilate, who was no lover of Jews for sure. He had crucified thousands and killed thousands much earlier, and the literature is filled with divided opinions. In fact, I would say that today probably the prevailing view is the Romans did it. In fact, Bill O'Reilly is coming out with a book soon called Killing Jesus. Got a lot of press because it's Bill O'Reilly, of course, and apparently they didn't say very much, but they said that he has new evidence about the Romans, that the Romans did it. I don't know, maybe between his broadcasts he's doing archaeological digs in Jerusalem or somewhere. And another book is coming out this month, I believe, coincidentally called Killing Jesus, in which there too I think it's the Romans did it. But the thing that I find astonishing, if you have this split opinion, how is it that historically I have not been able to find a single incident of Cossacks or marauders riding through a Roman village saying, get those Christ-killer Romans or the Italians who are their descendants. Not a single incident.
No, sir.
So that whoever you blame for this, and you have these intellectual exegeses on this subject among academics and writers, the fact is only Jews have been persecuted for it.
Right. The question is, why did the Jews get singled out? Even if there is Jewish culpability, Dr. Starr and I would have a different evaluation of the reliability of the Gospels. But why the Jews?
Cleansing flame, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. Friends, remember, 1 week from tomorrow, I will be at Pillars of Faith Church in Queens, New York. I'm coming in just to be with all of you. My listening audience in Pillars of Faith is graciously hosting the meeting. It's time for revolution in New York. We'll have free items to stir your heart that we'll be giving out to everyone. And it's going to be a great night. I believe a life-changing night as we have the privilege for our listeners, co-sponsored with WMCA, to be with you. So for info, go to askdrbrown.org, and you'll see this right on the homepage on my itinerary. My guest, Dr. Bernard Starr, psychologist, journalist, college professor, has been on a journey wanting to see who the real Jesus is and discovered to his surprise, wow, he's thoroughly Jewish. There was no such concept of Christian or Christianity during his lifetime. His book, Jesus Uncensored, Restoring the Authentic Jew, I would differ with Dr. Starr in terms of assessment of the accuracy of the Gospels. I believe things as presented there, he'd have a different take along with other critical scholars. But I find the book fascinating and a great book to read for both Jews and Christians. So, Dr. Starr, as we continue our conversation, there's so much to talk about. We both agree that for anyone to be persecuted for the death of Jesus is absolutely contrary to everything in the New Testament. And even when Peter preaches in Acts to his own people, to leaders who he says were responsible for turning Jesus over to the Romans, he says, you did it ignorantly, and God wants to bless you and have mercy on you. So the idea that it was then going to be a later predominantly Gentile church that would persecute Christ killers is complete departure from the roots of the faith. We both agree on that. But then things happen through the centuries. And again, I can only highlight certain parts of your book. But chapter 10, The Ethnic Cleansing of Judaism in Medieval and Renaissance Art, replete with color pictures. Can you take us on a brief journey of this? Obviously, we've got to get the book to look at the pictures, but give us a tour through the museums here.
Oh, well, okay, the way this whole thing started was that I noticed several paintings in a museum, particularly the first one that struck me was Mary Magdalene seeing the risen Jesus. Famous painting by an Italian, Fra Angelico. And Jesus and Mary Magdalene are blonde, fair-skinned, and uh-huh. They're in a blazing light, so the blondness is almost blinding in it. And I thought it was almost comical, the thing. And then I started looking at other paintings, and I saw there's a pattern here. Wait a second.
Now what was this first one painted that you referenced?
Fra Angelico.
Yeah.
Let's see. I think he was 14th century or 15th century.
Got it. Okay.
Not sure exactly.
All right. So we're talking about in any case later Middle Ages.
I'm talking about medieval, late medieval times and Renaissance.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. The paintings that I cover here from basically the 13th century through the 18th century. But that one caught me first. Mary Magdalene encountering the risen Jesus by Fra Angelico, and with the blazing blondness. And then I started noticing that all the paintings were that way. And not only that, but Jesus is uncircumcised, and only when you can notice it in most of the paintings. They're set in palatial settings, okay, which is very alien to their Galilean village origins and life. They're surrounded by totally Christian symbols. There's not a hint in any of the classic medieval or Renaissance paintings of any Judaism. In fact, if I'm looking at one here now that I have up on my computer screen, Madonna and Child enthroned with Saints Mary Magdalene and John the Baptist by Giuliano, another Renaissance painter. And you have Mary and Jesus on a throne there in some palace, and you have John the Baptist as an adult, which is kind of doesn't fit because he was pretty much the same age as Jesus. And an iconic image of him, which you find in a lot of the paintings, he's holding what appears to be a tall bamboo crucifix. Okay, so it's and in many of the others, you find that they're surrounded. You find Jesus and Mary surrounded by Latter-day Saints and crucifixes, and you find a painting where the betrothal of Mary and Joseph, and there are Christian bishops around them, but not a hint of anything Jewish there.
Amazing.
Okay, so it's totally washed out, and that's why I titled it "The Ethnic Cleansing of Judaism." Now, I believe. And I've and increasingly believe that as I study more and more of the paintings, that this was one of the great underpinnings of anti-Semitism, because essentially what it accomplished was to set Jesus apart in terms of religion and in terms of ethnicity from the Jews, the others. You know, and the code word for the Jews then becomes the Pharisees. There's Jesus, and then there's the Pharisees. And by the way, a lot of the art historians, when I present it to them, and of course, they immediately get haughty about it. You know, what right do I have? I'm not an art historian to say this. And they give me their view on it, that, well, you know, the Renaissance artists, they always contemporized everybody. They dressed them. And I looked and I said, well, you know, that's not true. You don't see Homer or Agamemnon kneeling in a Christian prayer pose surrounded by Christian saints. And then the other thing that I found is when these painters, or their patrons, and it's more due to the patrons, wanted to demonize Jews, they certainly did, and they were no longer blonde, blue-eyed, and fair-skinned. If you look at the tribute money by Peter Paul Rubens, for example, another 16th century painting, you have Jesus with the money changers there, and it's called the Tribute to Money, and Jesus looks very ethereal, and he's fair and blonde. And the others are all very menacing looking. They're the Jews, you see.
Okay,
they
probably have heavy eyebrows or the darker
hair. Well, okay, yeah, more than that. And then if you look at, and everybody should get a copy of this because I think it really makes the point, Christ Among the Doctors by Albrecht Dürer, okay? You know, another Renaissance painter, Dürer, he was a very famous painter. And here you have a very ethereal, looking Jesus, very saintly looking with reddish blonde hair, and he's surrounded by the doctors. You know, this is based on the Gospel of Luke, where Jesus is debating the doctors at the temple during Passover. He's 12 years old at the time. And not only are these Jews now, the others, menacing and dark, one of them looks almost subhuman. I mean, it's really kind of shocking.
Yeah, I'm looking at the picture right now on page 142 of your book. And
right.
Yeah. And by the way, it's a good reason to actually get the book in your hands. This is going to be a better quality than if you're just reading it, say, on a Kindle reader, as I also have it, to actually see the pictures. But it's, I mean, they knew how to make Jews look like Jews, and they knew how to make Jews look like demons, and they knew how to make Jesus look. I mean, he's so fair-haired here; he almost looks effeminate.
Right. He is very much so. So it's not true what the art historians say. That, oh, no, they just dismiss it. And, you know, then I stumbled across these other things. I wrote an article recently about an exhibit at the National Gallery that's very current right now, and it's about the pre-Raphaelite artists. And there's one painting there of Jesus as a boy in his father's, in Joseph's, carpentry shop, and it almost looks like a more recent painting, a cozy painting of a family at work. And it when it first was exhibited in when was it in the early 19th century, 1820 something or so, it received outrage from the public that they're presenting this Jew boy. There is an ordinary, you know, Jesus is a Jew boy, and ordinary looking. And it was amazing. I mean, the queen requested a copy of the painting, had it brought to Buckingham Palace because it created such a brouhaha. Okay, it's quite incredible, and that's why I've written several articles, and one of them of how artists invented the Christian Jesus.
Yeah, and it's, you know what, there's no way you can get that description from the Gospels. There's no way you can get it anywhere in the New Testament whatsoever. The mystery was that Gentiles were allowed in. We come back. What a fascinating discussion with Dr. Starr, Bernard Starr, the author of Jesus Uncensored, Restoring the Authentic Jew. I want to ask Dr. Starr what he'd like Jews to think about in terms of Jesus, and is it possible that Dr. Starr, that Jesus could be our Messiah? All right, we'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I want to get right back to my guest, Dr. Bernard Starr, long-term psychologist, journalist, college professor, and author most recently of Jesus Uncensored, Restoring the Authentic Jew. There'll be parts of the book, as a follower of Jesus or believer in the Scriptures, New Testament, that you will absolutely be eating up. Parts you'll differ with, other parts will challenge you, but it's a great read, and it's important as well. Dr. Starr, two last questions for you. I wish we had hours. Perhaps we can continue this discussion at a future time on the air. But two last questions for you, and if you could give the cliff note answer, because these could be answered by the hour. The cliff note answer, just because of our time frame here. Number one, what would you like Jewish people to do with Jesus or the New Testament, or about Jesus in the New Testament? Number two, I don't know if you believe in such a character as the Messiah, but is it possible that Jesus could be our Messiah?
Okay, number one, I think first Jews should read the New Testament, number one, and that's the big obstacle to overcome. After that, they will see, if they read it openly, and they should embrace Jesus as a dedicated, lifelong Jew. Okay, those are two things. Now, on the Messiah issue, that's obviously a very sensitive issue for Jews, and I would not like to lead with that because it's going to put them off. Is he the Messiah? Isn't he? Well, if you, by my Maimonides standards, you can't have a dead Messiah, but of course that's not a problem for Christians or for those who think he's the Messiah, because he's going to deliver whatever is promised with the that the Messiah is supposed to deliver in the second coming. Okay, that's fine. If he does, we'll all recognize that. But by the way, you mentioned Schneerson before, and if you go through Crown Heights in Brooklyn, you'll see signs, welcoming Schneerson, the Mashiach, the Messiah.
Will.
And he didn't deliver either. So if they believe that he's the Messiah, well, he has to do it in a second coming. And then I have this whole chapter on winking and blinking at Messiahs. Jesus wasn't the first Messiah to claim Messiah, or the last one. And there are Messiahs, quote Messiahs, that Jews consider false Messiahs, who they still revere, namely Isaac Luria, the Kabbalist. And
yes.
His disciple, Vital, who actually wrote all of his teachings, because Luria never wrote anything. And both of these, well, Luria was considered the Messiah. There's no question that Vital declared himself the Messiah. And Jews today, the Orthodox Jews who teach Kabbalah classes, teach the teachings of Isaac Luria. So there's a certain duplicity there. Oh, we won't even think about Jesus. We dismiss Jesus completely because he claimed he was the Messiah, da-da-da-da-da-da. Wait a second, there's a book called 50 Jewish Messiahs, and I've written about several of them in the chapters, and some of them were quite destructive to Judaism, and they are still respected. And I say, well, why the total dismissive attitude then toward Jesus? Jesus never did anything harmful to anybody. Show me one thing that he said or did that was harmful to Jews. I can show you a lot that these other messiahs did
absolutely.
That was destructive.
Well, Dr. Starr, I'm thrilled to hear these things from you. Obviously, we don't get have time to get into all the book or the Da Vinci Code issues. I don't know if you're at my debate on that one in New York City. But I'm thrilled to hear this. And, of course, for our listeners, they're all smiling and say, oh, yeah, he's closer than he realizes. I appreciate what you're saying and why you're saying it, and it's a delight to interact with you. Hopefully my next debate in New York, I can get to meet you face-to-face, and maybe we can continue the discussion on the air again another day. But thanks so much for joining us. It's been very enjoyable.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Dr. Bernard Starr, the book Jesus Uncensored, Restoring the Authentic Jew. Remember, their portions of the book I would absolutely differ with in terms of the reliability of the Gospels or other things like that or speculation. Much of the book I absolutely totally resonate with, but all of it is fascinating. It's really interesting. I mentioned it last week, but there are ultra-Orthodox Jews, it's a small group in terms of actively doing this, who are campaigning for another Sanhedrin to re-examine the trial of Yeshua, Jesus, and to say that we should not be rejecting him and casting him out the way we have. These, to me, are all major steps. And Dr. Starr knows exactly who I am, what I believe. He's read Real Kosher Jesus. He was at my debate in 2004 with Rabbi Shmuley on Who Really Killed Jesus. He was at my debate last year in New York City on Kosher Jesus. So he fully understands where I'm coming from. And I found it delightful to find out where he is on the journey. I mean, you just never know who comes to these debates. And all my friends in New York that were at these debates, who knew that it would get this Jewish professor, journalist, psychologist on a journey that would lead to a book like this and encouraging Jews to read the New Testament and find out more about Jesus. Friends, God is at work. God is at work among the Jewish people. And I want to say this to all my Jewish friends listening. No, don't hide. Nobody's looking at you. Just because I address, nobody's looking at you. You don't believe in Jesus, Yeshua. You're listening to me right now in Crown Heights or Williamsburg. You're listening to me in another part of the country or another country. You're doing this secretly, but you're very curious. Contact us, okay? Contact us, say personal and confidential for Michael Brown, all right? If you can't write in English, if you don't write well in English, write in Hebrew. Yiddish I'd have a problem with, but you can write in Hebrew or English. And if you're really seeking, we will not put your name in a database, okay? But tell me if you have questions. Sometimes it's difficult to get material out because if your family sees it, you'll be in trouble. So this happens to us. People say, all right, I want to read the book. I just don't know how to get it. But we'll figure out a way to communicate with you, get materials into your hand. Contact me. Just write to info@askdrbrown.org. info@askdrbrown.org. And we want to help you come to know exactly who Yeshua is, our Messiah and King, the very image of God in human form. And I think this should provoke all of you, if you haven't read The Real Kosher Jesus, and here my guest, who's not committed to Jesus being the Messiah, he's read the book. Make sure you get it. It's yours today for Thoroughly Jewish Thursday for your gift of any size. It's a $15 paperback. The number to call, 1-800-278-9978. By the way, if you're a Jewish person, you don't believe in Jesus, and you're willing to read the book, shoot us a note privately, tell us, and we'll send you a free copy. But everyone else, stand with us. Your gift of any size, those who can be generous, help those who cannot. 1-800-278-9978. Let me rephrase that. Many of you are being generous, but you don't have much to give. So those who have more to give, help those who have less to give. So we can send out as many of these books as possible. 1-800-278-9978. If you're listening on one place, just click donate. And with your donation today, we will gladly send you a copy of the book. My bottom line today, the Jesus who has been rejected, misunderstood, put out by our Jewish people, as the church put the Jewish people out and mistreated them. Now the real Jesus, the true Jesus, the real Yeshua is being rediscovered by more and more Jewish people. It's time for you to meet him yourself. You know, I have been answering Jewish objections to Jesus for more than 41 years now. So it's always fascinating to me when a sincere believer comes up to me and says, Dr. Brown, so why is it that Jews don't believe in Jesus?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us today on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire. You know, I get asked a lot of questions over and over again by sincere believers, sometimes people who've been Christians for decades, sometimes teachers of the word, pastors, and I'm struck by the question. My first thought is, are you serious? You don't know that? But then I realize I've got 1,000 blind spots, too, in areas that I just don't know the answers to. So I want to take some time on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast on the Line of Fire and respond to some of the most common questions that come up from Christians about why Jews don't believe in Jesus. And then I want to give answers to those questions, not just in terms of why Jews do not believe, meaning so many Jews do not believe in Jesus, Yeshua, but I also want to give responses to some of those fundamental Jewish objections. I won't be taking any calls today. I want to cover a lot of material. So you can interact with me if you like, though, on my Facebook page. That's Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown on Facebook. You can tweet me at hashtag doctor, that's Dr. Dr. Michael L. Brown, or best of all, where you can get lengthier comments and they'll be archived and folks can interact, go to AskDrBrown.org and click on the Line of Fire and you can add your comments, your questions for others to join in the discussion right there on today's broadcast. When I began years ago to start to put together a series of volumes on answering Jewish objections to Jesus, I divided the objections into six different categories. Originally, this was going to be a book, and then I realized, okay, it's going to be more than a book. It's going to be three volumes, and then I realized, actually, it's going to be four volumes, and then it became five volumes. And since it's come out, the five-volume series, It's been criticized and attacked and challenged over and again by rabbis and counter-missionaries. There are some websites with literally thousands and thousands of comments of people going back and forth about what I've written. So I'm really pleased that the books have had the impact we've desired. And whenever I travel out, especially in a Messianic Jewish congregation, I will run into people who came to faith through the books, Jewish people who came to faith through the books, or Jewish people who came back to the faith through the books, or Jewish people whose faith in Yeshua was maintained through the books. So let me just give you the broadest overview of the categories, six different categories that I covered in five different books, explaining why Jewish people through the centuries have rejected Jesus as Messiah. Now look, you're in love with Jesus, you know the Lord, your life has been changed, you read the word, it's so clear to you. You wonder, how could anyone ever wonder about this? How could anyone not see it? And it's beautiful that you have that faith, it's beautiful that you have that clarity, it's beautiful that things are so definite and certain to you. However, not everyone sees it like that. And there are many sincere people, rabbis, counter-missionaries, traditional Jews, secular Jews, and they've read the scriptures and they haven't seen it. It's wonderful when the light goes on. It's wonderful when people see things they've never seen before. But sometimes we need to pray, and along with that we need to patiently reason. And many times there are serious and sincere questions and objections that our Jewish friends have. So we're going to clear that up and give you a good foundational understanding on the broadcast today. So call a friend, tell them to tune in, and we will be right back. Yeah.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. Michael Brown, always delighted to be with you. You know, every there's a certain excitement I have doing radio every day, not just because I'm doing radio. That I love to do, and you know it. You can feel it. You can hear it in my voice. You can sense the smile as I talk to you. It's a privilege, and it's an honor. And I know there are other things you could be doing now. So to stop and listen to the broadcast means a lot to me, and I take every broadcast really seriously. That's why I broadcast from different parts of the world, take my radio equipment with me. We invested in high-tech radio equipment to travel with, and I broadcast from in the middle of the night in Hong Kong and India and places like that so we could come live and be with you. So it's a joy and honor to be with you. Each day there's a certain excitement I have dealing with each topic for each day, and Thoroughly Jewish Thursday has a rhythm of its own. So I'm trying to make today's broadcast as practical as I can. I'm not taking any calls, that's why I haven't given the number out. As practical as I can in terms of giving you an overview of Jewish objections to Jesus. A lot of Christians don't understand why Jewish people would reject Jesus. It's so obvious to them that Jesus, Yeshua, is the Messiah. They can't see any reason why anyone wouldn't believe in him. The Messianic prophecies are so clear. He's the only way to receive forgiveness and so on. And I appreciate that. Faith is wonderful. And yet there are many major issues that the Jewish community has raised against faith in Jesus, Yeshua, through the centuries. I have just finished teaching a 32-lecture, 16-hour series on answering Jewish objections to Jesus that will be used by the Messianic Jewish Bible Institute worldwide, and we hope to be able to air some of that as we go on TV, God willing, beginning in July on the NRB TV network. I have a 22-hour series on countering the counter-missionaries that's available through our website. 5 volumes of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, and then countless debates and articles and relevant material. But I want to give you an overview, all right? I want to give you an overview today so that you can get the bird's eye view of reasons that Jewish people don't believe in Jesus and will respond to them. So in the 5-volume series, I cover 6 different categories of objections. This is the way I divided them up, based on the main objections I heard from rabbis, counter-missionaries, counter-missionary books, major literature, debates, dialogue I had. I compiled them and put them in 6 different categories: general objections, historical objections, theological objections, messianic prophecy objections, New Testament objections, and objections based on traditional Judaism. So let me explain the breakdown, all right? And I'll do this section by section, and then I'll give you brief responses and then some samples of how we deal with things. We're just giving you a sampling today, but I think the overview will really help you. By the way, my book, The Real Kosher Jesus, we're going to do something again we did last Thursday, and I'm going to do it again. Your gift of any size, I want to send the book out to you. It's a $15 paperback plus postage. It's the number one book I've written to help Jewish people recognize who Jesus Yeshua is. It's the number one book I've written for followers of Jesus to better understand who he is. And in the course of the book, I tackle many of the principal objections that Jewish people raise to Jesus Yeshua. So the number to call, this is not to be on the air, but to get your copy, your gift of any size, those who can be generous, help those who cannot, and above all, help us with our radio outreach, 1-800-278-9978. This is by phone only. It's not listed online to do it like this. 1-800-278-9978. One more time, 1-800-278-9978. Or if you'd like to do it while listening on oneplace.com, click on donate and then put in your amount, and then we will process it accordingly from there. All right,
General objections. What do I mean by that? Well, these are in many ways the most common, least sophisticated, and often the most emotional objections. They contain broad generalizations. They make sweeping statements and are especially based on the perception of what Jews, quote, as a whole, believe and do. So the heart of these general objections is simply this: Jesus is not for Jews. Our religion is Judaism, not Christianity. No Jew would ever believe in Jesus. Now, I'll come back a little later in the broadcast and give you a sampling of some of these general objections and how we respond to them. But to a great extent, answering these objections is a matter of correcting misconceptions, as well as getting people to stop and think about the emotional and sometimes irrational nature of what they are saying. So what we want to do is help Jewish people understand that Jesus himself is Jewish, that the most Jewish thing a person can do is recognize him as Messiah, and separate things that may be associated with Christian tradition or the later church from what Scripture really says, and then explore what it really means to be a Jew. Now, the historical objections are more difficult, they're more substantial, and they deal with two main issues. Number one, what's the purpose of the Messiah? Well, Messiah brings peace to the world. When Jewish people are praying for the coming of the Messiah, and religious Jews are doing that on a daily basis, several times a day, praying for the coming of the Messiah and confessing their faith in his coming, when they do this, they're expecting the Messiah to come and bring peace on the earth. Now, you'll say, well, yeah, Jesus will do that when he returns. But since Jewish people don't believe in a first coming and a second coming, they're waiting for the Messiah to come and establish peace on the earth. Therefore, what would they say? Well, we know Jesus isn't the Messiah because he didn't bring peace on the earth. Now, the other part of the historical objection is this. Look at the church. Look at Jew hatred in church history. Look at the Crusades and the Inquisitions. Look at how Christianity, European Christianity, paved the way for the Holocaust. This is what many Jews would say and believe. Look at the church worldwide. You can't even agree between yourselves. Look at all the scandals and so on. So, you know, if Jesus is really the Messiah, what has he produced? So the heart of these objections is simply this. Jesus cannot be the Messiah because we are obviously not in the Messianic age. So how do we respond to those substantial objections? Well, what we do is we define clearly the purpose and mission of the Messiah. We give a biblical picture of the Messianic age. We express the difference between a New Testament Messianic Jewish expression of faith and a later corrupted Christian form. And we admit to the failures of the church while pointing to the glorious and profound changes brought about by the gospel, giving shining examples of the true Messianic faith. And the simple way that I often explain this is by saying that the Jewish people say when the Messiah comes, he will accomplish number 6 through 10 on the list. What we need to demonstrate is, no, first the Messiah had to come and accomplish numbers 1 through 5 on the list. And the one who accomplishes 1 through 5 is the only one who will also be able to accomplish 6 through 10. Are you following me so far? And those for whom this is too basic, well, be glad. Feel good about that. Because many, many believers don't understand why Jewish people reject Jesus as Messiah. And they don't understand it. If they do find the objections, they don't understand how to respond. Now, there's no put down. There are plenty of people you could have me talk to, and I don't know how to respond to them. I don't know how to deal with their issues. I don't know how to deal with their objections. There are different religious groups or cults that you have me deal with, and of course I can give what the Word says, but I may not be as familiar with their unique objections. So we're here to help equip you. We're here to help equip you to understand the Jewish people better, reach out with the love of God, and speak the truth about the Messiah. Okay, third category of objections, theological objections. And these objections are the most serious and cut to the heart of the differences between traditional Judaism and the Messianic Jewish or true Christian faith, and they revolve around nature of God, or Trinity, deity of Jesus, person of the Holy Spirit. They revolve around the question of the continuity of the law. Is it still binding in total? Was it abolished by Jesus or Paul? The nature of man, the need for salvation, sin, and the means of atonement. In some, these objections claim that the religion of the New Testament is a completely foreign religion, which is not only un-Jewish, but is also unfaithful to the Hebrew Bible. I'll explain how we respond to those objections, not with cheap answers, but with wonderful insights from Scripture, and then break down the other principal categories of Jewish objections to Jesus when we return right here. And remember to be praying for the Jewish people worldwide that Messiah Yeshua, Messiah Jesus, will be gloriously revealed to them.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yes, it's true. I often know what day of the week it is by what I am covering on radio. So today must be Thursday because it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us today on the Line of Fire. I'm not taking your calls, but I am going through an explanation of the main reasons why Jewish people don't believe in Jesus, and then giving an overview of how we respond to those objections. If you'd like to interact further on the subject, go to my website, askdrbrown.org, and click on the Line of Fire, and you can get involved in discussion there. Oh, real quick, before I get back to the categories of objections, do you know how we came up with the name Thoroughly Jewish Thursday? Do you know how? It was a little over 2 years ago when we were expanding our radio outreach massively that I got the idea of covering different topics on different days. Before that, it could cover any subject on any given day. Now, if the news was pressing or I felt impressed by the Lord in some urgent way to do that, of course we could do it. It's our own radio show and it's live radio. But I thought, you know, I'm going to be thematic. And Monday was kind of a day where whatever happened over the weekend, I might want to talk about that, or I may have a burden about something or a real interest in a question that came up. So we never knew what would happen on Monday. Tuesday, we're going to focus especially on the Word of God, theological controversies, apologetics, practical teaching. Wednesday, we're going to focus on moral cultural issues. Thursday, we're going to focus on Jewish issues. And Friday, that was the one day that was already established. You've got questions, we've got answers. But when I go on the road and talk to people, I found that they didn't know which day was which. And I thought, okay, how can I help people remember that? And I thought, all right, let's come up with something that'll work for each day. So Monday with an M, Monday is Monday's musings. So whatever's on my mind that I want to talk about, Monday's musings. Tuesday, teaching. Wednesday, the world. Moral cultural issues, right? Wednesday, the world. Thursday, Jewish. What could we come up with? And one of our listeners suggested Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So that name, which is the best remembered name of the week, is due to one of our dear listeners. And Friday had already been established as you've got questions, we've got answers. So I figured I didn't have to come up with something that alliterated with Friday. All right, two major categories of Jewish objections to Jesus, general objections and historical objections. Now theological objections, which I've basically summed up as saying this. The religion of the New Testament is a completely foreign religion, which is not only un-Jewish, but is also unfaithful to the Hebrew Bible. So issues, say, messianic prophecy, did Jesus fulfill the prophecies? Those are secondary to this, since Jesus is viewed as a false prophet and the founder of an alien faith. So our answers here seek to distinguish between what the Hebrew Bible actually says in distinction from later Jewish traditions, what the New Testament actually says in distinction from later church traditions, and how Jewish tradition at times underscores the essential Jewishness of our beliefs. Next category, objections based on messianic prophecies. So this I deal with general and historical objections I deal with in Volume 1 of my series, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, Volume 1. Theological objections, that's its own volume, Volume 2. Objections based on messianic prophecies, that's its own volume, Volume 3, as are the last two categories. So traditional Judaism strongly rejects our standard messianic proof text, claiming that, and they'll call them proof texts, claiming that they have nothing to do with Jesus, or that they've been mistranslated, misquoted, or taken out of context by the New Testament authors or traditional Christian apologists, or arguing that none of the real messianic prophecies, the so-called provable prophecies, were ever fulfilled by Jesus. So a Jewish person is then saying, we don't believe Jesus is the Messiah because he didn't come close to living up to the biblical description of the Messiah. How do we answer these objections? Well, we go back to the Hebrew Scriptures. We rediscover that the Messiah's mission was both priestly, hence involving atonement for sin, as well as royal, and then by noting that the Scriptures point to a twofold coming of the Messiah, whose first arrival had to be before the second temple was destroyed in the year 70 CE, 70 of this era, and by examining the alleged misinterpretations of biblical prophecies, also pointing out different ways of understanding the words of the New Testament authors, and where relevant, we bring in support from traditional Jewish literature. Then, objections based on the New Testament, those are several categories. Traditional Jews or counter-missionaries or rabbis would say the New Testament misquotes and misinterprets the Old Testament. At times, it manufactures verses to suit its purposes. The genealogies of Jesus given by Matthew and Luke are hopelessly contradictory at best and entirely irrelevant anyway. The New Testament is filled with historical and factual errors, especially Stephen's speech. The teachings of Jesus are impossible, dangerous, and un-Jewish, and Jesus as a person was not so great either. The New Testament is even self-contradictory. These are traditional Jewish and classic Jewish objections to the New Testament. So in the mind of a traditional Jew, I mean, only a fool would believe in the divine inspiration of the New Testament. So how do we deal with that? Well, we say, right, let's look at problems in the Hebrew Scriptures where there seem to be contradictions and difficulties. How do we deal with those? Then let's look at the Jewishness of the thought patterns and ideas of the New Testament. Then let's provide answers to apparent contradictions and distortions. And as for other alleged historical contradictions and issues, well, there are plenty of other books and encyclopedias of Bible difficulties and things that answer those. And then the last volume of my five-volume series deals with objections based on traditional Judaism. And we're talking in particular religious Jews would say two main things. Judaism is a wonderful, fulfilling, and self-sufficient religion. There's no need to look elsewhere. And God gave us a written and an unwritten tradition. We interpret everything by means of the oral tradition without which the Bible makes no sense. So how do we answer these objections? Well, we refute the notion that there's an unwritten, unbroken, binding tradition going back to Moses, demonstrating that the written word provides the foundation of our faith, and then we explain why all people, including Jews, need the Messiah. Now, friends, if you want to dig into this in great depth, get the five-volume series. You can get it on our website at a discount or at any online book dealer. You can get our 22-hour series on countering the counter-missionaries on DVD or CD. Those are all available on our website, AskDrBrown.org. But for a great overview and answers to many of the key questions, my book, The Real Kosher Jesus, will be really helpful to you. Plus an eye-opening adventure. You'll have a hard time putting it down. And it's available today. We did this last Thursday. I want to do it again. Your gift of any size, it's a $15 paperback, but we appreciate your generosity. Your gift of any size, and here's the number to call, 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. And friends, I want to encourage you, God is doing great things among the Jewish people worldwide. We are really in a season of harvest and grace. Back with specific objections and their answers.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, thank you for being part of the broadcast today. I'm not taking calls. I've been spending time the last half hour, and for those just tuning in now, I'm going to jump right in. I've been spending time explaining the main categories of Jewish objections to Jesus, and then just giving a very short overview of how we respond to each of these categories. And I've been doing this as a Jewish follower of Jesus, Yeshua, for over 41 years now. And I'm giving an overview of how we respond to these, but I want to give a sampling of some of the objections and how we respond to help equip you, to help familiarize you, to help introduce you to the subject, and sharpen those who have been doing this as well. Just another reminder for everyone in the greater Atlanta area, I'm coming your way. In fact, tonight I should be arriving with my wife Nancy, and we'll be about an hour south of Atlanta, or an hour outside of Atlanta, I should say, in Coweta, Georgia, doing meetings Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday morning, Sunday night. So if you're spiritually hungry and thirsty, if you believe that God's fire and revival is for today, please join us for these meetings. We're really going to be looking to the Lord and turning to Him. We should have a great time of worship as well as prayer and preaching and ministry. And if you're one of our torchbearers, one of our monthly supporters, I would love to meet you face-to-face at the meetings. Okay, so general objections to Jesus. This is the first of our categories. What kind of objections are these? Well, things like Jews don't believe in Jesus. You know, if I ask you as a Christian, why don't you believe in Muhammad? You'd say, well, I'm a Christian, not a Muslim. Have you read the Quran? Have you studied the Quran? Have you looked at the life of Muhammad? Most would say, no, I'm a Christian. We don't believe that. We know he's not the real thing. He's a false prophet. Well, the Jewish perception would be Jews don't believe in Jesus. So that's the most basic. In fact, it's the first objection out of all the ones I tackled in my Jewish objections books. What's the answer to that? Well, Jews do believe in Jesus. I mean, first thing, Jesus himself is Jewish. The reason I answer Jewish objections to Jesus as opposed to Jewish objections to Yeshua is because most Jews don't know who Yeshua is. They never heard of that. So we need to tell them, yeah, his name is Yeshua. He's not the son of Mr. and Mrs. Christ. The reason he's called Christ is the Greek way of saying Messiah. Yeah. Jesus, Yeshua, the Messiah. And his mother's name was Miriam. Oh. Most Jews wouldn't know that, as simple as it is. And there are Christians you can run into on the street. You ask them, what does Christ mean? They don't know that, which is a little scary. They think it's a name or something as opposed to meaning Messiah. And then we need to explain, do you know, all of Jesus' first followers were Jews. Yeah. Men with names like Yaakov and Yochanan and Matthai and, oh, yeah. And in fact, the big question among his first believers were, can you be Gentile and believe in him? Or do you have to become Jewish to follow the Jewish Messiah? And then something that may surprise a lot of Jews is at least 1% of the Jewish population worldwide. Many would say 2%. Many would say higher. Do believe in Jesus, Yeshua, the Messiah. And when you realize that worldwide, it's only about 10% of the Jewish community that is Orthodox, and in terms of ultra-Orthodox, what, 5%? Well, maybe it's climbing. That number's climbing, but it's not, you know, 20, 30, 40% or something like that. So when you say, hey, at least 2% of the worldwide Jewish population believes in Jesus, the Messiah, you're simply saying it's a myth to say Jews don't believe in him. He himself is Jewish. All his first followers were Jewish. And there are several hundred thousand Jews who believe in him as Messiah today. It's a simple objection. It's a major misconception. And opening this up, the Jewishness of Jesus, and you can be a good, true Jew and believe in him, that's very important. We're going to get a little deeper. We come back on the other side of the break.
Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to our thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. I'm smiling because I somehow got tongue-tied on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. It's easy to say, isn't it? It's my delight to be with you. I'm not taking calls today. I'm going through the main categories of reasons that Jewish people object to Jesus being the Messiah, and then giving a sampling, okay, here's one of those objections, here's how we respond. And in my five-volume series, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, I broke down the objections into six categories: general objections, historical objections, theological objections, objections based on messianic prophecy, objections based on the New Testament, objections based on traditional Judaism. So one of the major objections that's raised is a historical objection, is this: if Jesus was the Messiah, there would be peace on earth. We know when the Messiah comes, he'll bring peace on earth. Jesus didn't bring peace on earth, therefore he's not the Messiah. Now, on a certain level, it's so simple and basic that you'd have to say, okay, there's got to be more to it. No, not to the objection, but to the reason that people looked at that and said, yeah, we understand that, but Jesus is the Messiah. I mean, look, if people were expecting President Barack Obama to show up and speak somewhere, and I got there to speak, and the Secret Service let me in, and they put me up there behind the presidential podium, and I began to speak, and I was introduced as President Barack Obama, you'd say, wait, something's going on there. You're not President Obama. Everybody knows you're not President Obama. But if, in fact, I was introduced and given the platform and was able to speak, you'd say, right, what's going on here? I mean, you're not President Obama. Well, maybe the real announcement wasn't heard clearly. Maybe the announcement was Dr. Michael Brown will be coming first to speak before President Obama comes, or something like that, all right? I'm not giving a precise analogy. In fact, as an analogy, it's not exact in terms of what I'm saying. What if the Messiah's mission was more than just bringing peace on the earth? What if the Messiah's mission was first to come and die for the sins of the world, and then to bring atonement to all human beings through his death on the cross, and to raise up his Jewish people to bring this message to the Gentile world, and for that message to spread through the world, and after it had spread through the world, and the world had an opportunity to receive God's grace or reject God's grace, at the end of that time, the Messiah would return and finish his mission. You say, well, where is that in the Bible? I'm a Jewish person. I read that for years. Where is there a second coming in the Bible? Well, what we want to do is look at the range of prophecies. We look at the range of prophecies and we realize that some of them speak of Messiah's royal work as the king, that he will rule and reign on the earth. And some of them speak of his priestly mission as a priestly king, which we can clearly demonstrate as part of the Messiah's mission in the scriptures. And as a priestly king, he brings redemption. As a priestly king, he deals with sin first. As a priestly king, he dies, and he, as the righteous one, takes the place of all of us, the unrighteous ones, so as to bring us to God. Now, in my book, The Real Kosher Jesus, I have a chapter on the secret of the priestly Messiah that will deal with this subject directly and will really help you with it, as well as a chapter called The Secret of the 6,000 Years. That will really help you as well to understand exactly what we are talking about. But let me give you, again, a very brief response. Look with me at the end of Isaiah 52, beginning in verse 13. There it tells us the servant of the Lord, which even some ancient Jewish tradition recognizes as the Messiah. The servant of the Lord will be highly exalted. Jewish tradition says he'll be more exalted than Abraham. He'll be higher than Moses. He'll be more lifted up than the ministering angels, to paraphrase an ancient tradition. But then it says, just as many as were astonished at you, just focusing directly at him, that his face was so marred, he was so beaten, bruised, that you couldn't even tell he was a human being. That's how disfigured he would be. But then it says he will sprinkle, some would say startle, many nations. Kings will shut their mouths because of him. For things that they've never heard or seen, they'll be shocked. They'll be shocked. This is part of the mystery of the Messiah's mission that became clear when Jesus, yes, born as King of the Jews, died as King of the Jews, but also as our great high priest. And yes, he will be highly exalted, but first he will terribly suffer. And as you read through Isaiah 53, he will die, and he will be rejected by his own people, and then he will continue in life, meaning rise from the dead, and his sufferings will not be for himself, because he was righteous and guiltless. His sufferings will be for us, for our sins. So that begins to pave the way for the understanding that there are two phases to his work, and then we can see from other scriptures as we lay out in The Real Kosher Jesus and in Volume 2 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus that the Messiah had to come and complete the first part of his mission, the priestly part of his mission, before the Second Temple was destroyed. Let's give a sampling of a theological objection. A theological objection. Well, we'd be told that Numbers 23:19, 1 Samuel 15:29 are crystal clear. And those verses tell us God is not a man. If you say that Jesus is God, or that God came into the world and became a man, that's idolatry. Making a man into a god, making God into a man, that's idolatry. Plus, we know from Deuteronomy 4 that when the children of Israel stood on Mount Sinai, God said to them, "You saw no form, but people saw Jesus." How do we explain that? That's one of the major theological objections, and I deal with it in depth of Volume 3 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, but I also take it up in a chapter called The Secret of the Invisible God Who Can Be Seen. So how do we answer that question, that major Jewish objection? Simply this: we explain that God, the creator of the universe, is one God and only one God, but he is complex in his unity. He is infinite in his being and complex in his unity. And the one who created the universe sits enthroned in heaven, but by his spirit he fills the universe. Doesn't Psalm 139 say that there's nowhere that you can flee from God's spirit? Doesn't he say in Jeremiah 23 that he fills heaven and earth? He fills heaven and earth by his spirit. He sits enthroned in heaven, ruling and reigning. And yet he sometimes appears in visible form and manifests himself among us, or localizes his presence like he did in the tabernacle or the temple. Sometimes he would appear in human form. You say, but then he's no longer God. No, we're talking about God complex in his unity. As we understand through his triunity, and as explained clearly in the New Testament, unfolding what's already seen in the Hebrew scriptures in the Old Testament, the Father, the source of all things, is unseen. That's why in the Hebrew scriptures he says, "No one can see my face and live." And that's why the New Testament reiterates that. John 1:18, "No one has seen God." It's repeated in John 5. Jesus said, "You've never seen his form." It's repeated in 1 Timothy 6. He's invisible. He dwells in unapproachable light, and yet he's often seen. How? Through his Son, who proceeds forth from him, the Word that goes forth from him. So in Genesis 18, he's seen in visible human form. At times he appears like in Isaiah 6, where the prophet sees him, or Ezekiel 1, where the prophet sees him, or Exodus 24, where 74 Israelite leaders, Moses, Aaron, and his two oldest sons, and 70 elders, see the God of Israel on Mount Sinai. The secret of the invisible God who can be seen is made known through Jesus Yeshua. That's why Colossians 1 tells us he is the image of the invisible God. And that's why Hebrews 1 tells us that he is the express image of his character and the very shining forth of his being. No, God is not a man. God did not cease to be God and come down as a human being. God remains eternal God, but he has the capability at the same time of visiting us in the person of his Son and even pitching a human tent in which to live for 33 years. All right, we're going to come back and give you samples of the last three categories of objections right here on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I'm going to do my best to move quickly on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I'm not taking calls today, but of course, you can weigh in as always on my website, askdrbrown.org. Click on the Line of Fire for today's broadcast. Add your comments or questions there. I've been going through the main categories of Jewish objections to Jesus to help enlighten, instruct, help you to understand why Jewish people through the centuries have had a problem with Jesus. Now, again, I cover it in a five-volume series in a 22-hour DVD class, as well as in briefer form in The Real Kosher Jesus. So get those resources. I'll tell you how you can get hold of The Real Kosher Jesus shortly. But everything else is available through our website, askdrbrown.org. All right. The next category of objections we've covered, general, historical, theological, messianic prophecy objections. When I say I've covered, introduced, and given you a sample. What would be a sampling of Jewish objections to the messianic prophecies we'd use? Well, perhaps the most famous of all the messianic prophecies we quote would be Isaiah 53. And there'd be many traditional Jewish objections to it. One would be it's not speaking about the Messiah, it's speaking about Israel. Now, there are some traditional ancient Jewish interpreters that understood Isaiah 53 to be speaking about the Messiah. So that tradition does exist within Judaism. However, the great majority of commentaries, and then through the centuries, the great majority of Jewish teachers have said, no, it doesn't speak about the Messiah at all. And of course, that could be a direct reaction against Christians preaching that this indeed is Jesus. So we'd be told, if you look at the context, you'll see the servant of the Lord is Israel. Actually, if you look at the context, you'll see sometimes the servant of the Lord is Israel, and sometimes the servant of the Lord is disobedient, blind, deaf, dumb Israel. And then you'll see sometimes the servant of the Lord is an individual, and that individual is working on behalf of Israel. That is the case in Isaiah 53. You say, well, how do you know that? Well, context is helpful as we move up to that chapter, but also the fact that if Israel was righteous, as the servant of the Lord is righteous and without guile and called my righteous servant by God in the chapter, then Israel would not be suffering in exile. Israel would not be suffering for the sins of the foreign nations. Israel would be the head and not the tail, based on the idea that God gave covenant blessings and curses, right? Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, if you obey, you'll be blessed. If you disobey, you'll be cursed. If they were obedient, they'd be blessed. You say, well, what about the righteous remnant? Could it be a righteous remnant? That's a better theory. But the problem is, according to this passage, it was the suffering of the servant of the Lord that brought healing to those that smote him. The suffering of the servant of the Lord that brought healing, I should say more exactly, to the guilty. And yet, when the righteous remnant suffered in different nations, God then judged those nations. It's only the Messiah that fits the builder. Now, there are many, many more answers we could give to the objections, but that's just an example. What about an example of a New Testament objection? We can't believe this New Testament because it's filled with errors and it doesn't interpret the Hebrew Scriptures properly. It even makes things. Let's look at one of those alleged make things up. Psalm 40 is a psalm where the psalmist says, sacrifice and offering you didn't desire. And then it says in the Hebrew, Osnayim Karita Li, which I'll come back to. Burnt offering, sin offering you didn't ask for. Then I said, behold, I come in the volume of the book, it's written about me. I come to do your will. And Hebrews 10 takes that up and says that when the Messiah comes into the world, he says, sacrifice and offering you don't desire, but a body you've prepared for me. Whereas the Hebrew, Osnayim Karita Li, could mean my ears you have dug out. In other words, open my ears so I could hear if my ears were stuck with things. But it's really, it bore, dig out in an aggressive way. It could mean cut in a sense of pierced. My ears you've pierced. Perhaps like the slave that said, I'm going to serve my master for life. And the slave would have his ear pierced with an awl. In any case, because the Hebrew was somewhat difficult, the Septuagint rendered it differently. Now, the Septuagint was the Greek translation made by Jews in the couple hundred years before the New Testament era, before Jesus came into the world. And the Septuagint translates with, a body you prepared for me. What? Well, either they understood the Hebrew differently or had a different Hebrew text before them, or they simply explained it, if you have opened my ears so that I am now ready to submit, ready to serve, they paraphrased it by saying, a body you prepared for me. But that's not the big thing in Hebrews 10. That's not the main point the author of Hebrews is making. Why is he quoting that Greek version? Because that's the Jewish version that his Jewish Greek-speaking readers would read. He only mentions the body part thereafter once. The big issue is the revelation that what God really wanted was not sacrifice and offerings, but the Messiah's life. And the psalmist catches hold of that. You want me, when you talk about the sacrifice and offering, it's me, it's my life you want. Ah, but he can't do it. Only the Messiah can. It's a gloriously Jewish interpretation. Great spiritual insight from the writer of Hebrews in Hebrews 10. And he's just quoting the Jewish Greek translation. What about the objections that are based on traditional Judaism? We've covered general objections, historical objections, theological objections, messianic prophecy objections, New Testament objections. Just a sampling, just a little cup out of the ocean. What about traditional Jewish objections? What about the objection that God gave an oral tradition to Moses that goes all the way back to Mount Sinai, and the covenant was made based on the oral understanding of the written words? And that's the only way we can understand the Hebrew scriptures. The answer to that, the best way to refute that, is not only is there no evidence of an authoritative oral tradition going back to Moses reflected in the Hebrew scriptures. There are plenty of traditions, and not everything that Moses received was necessarily written down, but everything on which the covenant was based was written down, and that's how we argue it. We show that every single reference where God refers to the law of Moses, or what he commanded Moses, or to the law, or to God making a covenant, it is always to the written word, and that was the one and only thing that was preserved. We have our answers, a rich resource of answers to every objection. And that's why we never fear the objections. All right, the most practical single book I can get into your hands to help you with this and to enlighten you is The Real Kosher Jesus. We did this last Thursday. The response was so good, I want to do it once more. Your gift of any size, be as generous as you can. It's a $15 paperback. Your gift of any size will send you The Real Kosher Jesus, and it may just be the most enjoyable, informative book you've read in years. Call this number right now, 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. One more time, 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, yes, there are many, many serious Jewish objections to Jesus being the Messiah, but thanks be to God, there are glorious, serious, truthful answers to every objection. Our faith is based on absolute truth.